Good afternoon, and welcome to another hour of We the People Radio. You are listening to us on November 22nd, 2020. And my name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. If you're looking for anything John Deere or Honda or Steel Power Products, go by and see them. They've got a great inventory right now, just in time for the holiday. And you can go there at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, or give them a call at 226-9226. Check with them. They've got parts, service. They got it all going on up there. Or get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Yeah, chainsaws, generators.
Generators, weed whackers, edge trimmers.
How's the mower business?
Mowers. Mowers are a little tough to get, but they've got a whole inventory coming in. Should be there by about mid next month. So should be there in time for Christmas. Check with them and get an order in now.
Everybody needs under the tree is a mower.
Yeah, brand new mower. Drive it in stealthily in the middle of the night.
Yeah, Santa can bring it down the chimney.
Don't engage the deck.
I wonder if Santa has to wear a mask. Oh, we just got rid of Santa, though, didn't we?
Yeah, Santa, no.
Yeah, Santa's out.
Santa's out.
Now they're doing all this drive-up stuff. You have to drive your kids up. Well, can you imagine what a weird childhood these kids are having right now?
They're doing the deliveries by drones now, so we don't need Santa.
Some countries, those deliveries are bad.
Yeah.
Like the ones we've been talking about. So our guest this hour is Dr. Peter Vincent Bry, and we do several shows with him each quarter. Sometimes we have a show every month, actually. But we've done a lot of different things. I have them all listed on the page for today, and they are also listed on the National Security page. He's a wealth of information, and it's always information that doesn't work well as a little 2-minute interview soundbite. He has a lot more detail than that. And so we're really always happy to give him a place to fully explore the ideas so that we can actually learn things rather than be told what to think. I think there's enough telling people what to think everywhere else. We're not part of that team. We don't like to be told what to think, so we don't figure you do either. All right, Dr. Bry, how would you like to fire off this hour for us?
Well, I also
we kind of cut you off at the last hour.
Participation in your We the People Radio too, because I get good ideas as well, like buying a lawnmower for my wife for Christmas. I'm sure that will go over very well.
Yeah, you want to be careful with that one.
That's right.
It's when you go for the chainsaw and the weed whacker that you probably have problems.
Whatever you do, don't buy her a vacuum cleaner. I made that mistake one time. That probably
I buy my own vacuum cleaner.
Yeah. Well, I was also struck during the break about the news report about Russian dictator Vladimir Putin not being willing to acknowledge Biden as president yet. That he wants to wait for the process to work its way out before all these things are settled. And it's just striking that the Russian dictator apparently understands better our constitutional process than the liberal mainstream, the left-wing mainstream media that apparently does not know how the Constitution works and how the election process is supposed to work in this country. But where I would like to go, I mean... let's go down the path of talking about what is the security environment, the national security environment, likely to look like under a Biden administration if that happens. And if we've got time, since Thanksgiving is almost upon us, I'd like an opportunity, maybe the last 15 minutes or so, to talk about the unknown history of Thanksgiving. Or maybe even do that in the last half hour, I don't know.
Okay.
But that might be worth talking about. The a Biden administration, what I would call national security in an Orwellian America, because that's what I think we will become. I think national security is going to really have, a really low priority. If the model is correct and the theories are correct, and I think they are, that Biden is just going to be a figurehead for the far left. So what we're looking at is an American foreign and defense policy and domestic policy that is going to be shaped by the far left's agenda, not the moderate agenda that Biden at least is perceived as being, you know, for his many decades in government. And that means, you know, deep cuts to the defense budget, because in order to realize their socialist utopian vision, you know, paying off student loans, free education for everybody, a guaranteed level of income for everybody, combating climate change. Climate change, of course, is going to be our World War II, as they have put it. That's where our focus and most of our efforts is going to go. And
yeah,
I think that's no joke for them, even though many of them may not even believe in climate change. It is the big lie that all totalitarian movements need in order to convince the population to make extraordinary sacrifices. You know, for communism, the big lie was that you can realize a socialist utopia through class warfare. And so if you can get rid of these anti-progressive elements in your society by killing them and imprisoning them and sending them off to gulags and trusting your government to do the right thing, because your government is supposed to be representative of the working class, that you can realize a workers' paradise. That was their big lie, the Marxist-Leninist idea that that class warfare, that all the evils in the world were the result of capitalism, what Marx called capitalism. I like to call it free enterprise. The Nazis' big lie was that all problems are caused by an international Jewish conspiracy. And so if you get rid of those people, you know, you can realize an Aryan paradise. And the big lie of the Democrat Party, which is now a totalitarian movement, I mean, it's becoming a totalitarian movement for many years, but it is now a totalitarian movement, is this idea, one of their big lies, is this idea of climate change, that climate change is the, in 12 years, if we don't bend every effort,
world's,
you know,
over.
Right, you know, and this gives them an excuse to reach down to every aspect of our lives, you know, to change the way our energy infrastructure works, to change our lifestyles, to make us to abandon the materialist values, so-called materialist values that we have, you know, in terms of the kinds of houses we live and everybody owns a car and all of that, you know, because all of this stuff increases our carbon footprint. You know, it justifies anything. And many of them may not even believe it. The science certainly doesn't support this at all. So if there are intelligent people on their side, I don't see how they can believe it if they're actually driven by science. But it's a necessary thing, because especially to enlist the young in their movement, you know, and
it's back to the fear again. You know, it's always the fear. We have to scare everybody. And it's interesting, though, because their hysteria over the virus has kind of worked against them, because their big plan has been to make everybody, you know, make it so difficult to live in rural America, you know, with the regulations and I won't even get into it, but a lot of what goes on in rural America is a lot of it's just a big, hey, get out. You know, you can't get fire insurance, our forests aren't managed, so you deal with smoke all summer, you have all these problems. So their big push has been, if you move into the city, it's all better. It's kind of funny. Then the virus came, you were trapped in your little rabbit hutch there in the city, and that was not fun. And then they decided to get rid of the police. Now it's, you know, crime is rampant. Oops, that's not fun either. So I think their whole big push to get everybody crammed into the cities has completely come unglued after this virus.
And that brings us to
which
another
awesome.
One of their big lies, which is that the United States is a structurally racist, sexist, homophobic, you know, intolerant kind of a system that can't be reformed, but needs to be destroyed root and branch, even to the point of destroying our history, to begin on a tabula rasa, a blank slate. Every totalitarian movement does that.
Yep.
So those who may be listening, those few who may think that I'm overstating by calling the Democrat Party a totalitarian movement. I mean that exactly, you know, because it has all the earmarks of one. And their objectives, their intolerance of the political opposition to the point that there's no reasoning with them. And we've seen this over the 4 years with President Trump. You know, in effect, you know, the biggest scandal in terms of their attacks on President Trump all this time isn't just that the attacks were illegal and unconstitutional and that they were unfair and unwarranted against the president. The big scandal is that, in effect, they nullified the votes of the millions of Americans that voted for President Trump, our ability to steer the ship of state. I mean, that's how the, a civilized constitutional republic is supposed to work. You know, yeah, you can disagree. You can be the loyal opposition. But you have to obey the law. You have to stay within the rules of the Constitution. And the Republican Party has been very weak in being the opposition. That's why I actually blame the Republicans, too, for the fact that the Democrat Party has become a totalitarian party, because they failed in their constitutional role to be a robust, effective opposition party. In a lot of ways, they've just been a fake party, you know, paying lip service to the principles of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and all that, while they developed cozy relationships with you know, the big industries, lining their pockets and retiring in, you know, being as corrupt as the Democrats are.
And in a good
in
way,
economic relationship.
The last 4 years have really, shown a pretty bright light on all of that, and a lot of people have cleared out. Actually, we've done a bit of house cleaning, which is nice. You can always stand some house cleaning. We've got to take a really quick break. I thought we should celebrate a little of our choices here before Thanksgiving, because it is our life, and we should get to make the choices.
Yep.
Here in America. Hit it, Ashley. Two excellent songs for your Thanksgiving dinner table. While you hang out with as many people as you want, eating indoors or out. Oh my gosh. Yeah, the rules of Thanksgiving have gotten a little overblown. But so Dr. Pry, back on the Republican resistance part of it, what are you seeing as far as the housekeeping, or house cleaning, I should say? We've had a lot of seat changes over the last 4 years and a lot of attitude changes. I mean, who would have thought, you know, Lindsey Graham would have been a sword swinger?
Well, I think he is only in a sword swinger when he has to be.
Sure.
And then he'll go back.
But he was never even good at faking it before.
Right, right. And he's one of the people that's been so responsible and deserves to be blamed for the Democrats becoming what they are, you know, because he's never fought back.
Mm-mm.
You know, when he had that vital chairmanship and kept promising he was going to investigate the coup d'etat against President Trump and never did it. Not a single person has gone to jail on the Democrat side for, or even been inconvenienced, really, you know. Whereas Republicans who are perfectly innocent of anything, including General Flynn, you know, have had their lives ruined. And so this ineffectual Republican resistance to the growing trend of totalitarianism in the Democrat Party is responsible for making the Democrats what they are. You know, we have taught them over decades that they can get away with this kind of behavior. And it's not like, you know, one of the things that should be a wake-up call for people is I was glad to see Rudy Giuliani say during his press conference that the Democrats have been cheating on elections, stealing elections for years.
Mm-hmm.
And that is true. It isn't a recent phenomenon. I think that this recent case is extraordinary, you know, where it's the biggest, it amounts to a coup d'etat, okay? Another coup d'etat, which hopefully will turn into an attempted one. But it's hard to see how we win, you know. So many things have to go right, and you have to rely on federal courts that have also been corrupted. But it has been going on for years, and including level of political violence from the Democrat side. And I guess in past decades, they were still, despite a lot of misbehavior, they were still roughly within the definition of the loyal opposition, within the bounds of the Constitution, even though there were a lot of illegal acts, that the mainstream leaders of the party were not revolutionaries, okay?
Right.
But that is what has changed. So the mainstream is now left-stream, and they are a revolutionary totalitarian movement. I can remember during the Nixon-JFK race, I think I was 6 years old at the time, and going to first grade, and my father... you know, where I grew up, it was I went to Marcy Elementary School, which is here near Utica, New York, and it was largely a union town, okay? And if you're a union, you voted Democrat. But my father, who was an independent-minded guy, was going to vote Republican, voted for Nixon. And he and my mother often talked politics at the dinner table, and we were cautioned, the three of us, myself and my two brothers, don't tell anybody when you're going to school that Papa is voting for Nixon, okay, that we're a Nixon family. Don't tell them. And I remember driving on the beans.
Your first top secret mission.
Yeah, to the first grade class with my two brothers next to me, and the kids were singing some anti-Nixon song. Part of it went, I still remember part of it that went something like, Nixon is a jerk, put him in a coffee pot and listen to him perk. And the kids were just singing that over and over again.
Nice.
And I got so mad. I got up and started shouting at them, but Kennedy is a jerk. And my older brother pulled me down and tried to shut me up, but it was out. And they knew the Pry family were Republicans. And for the rest of my existence, for both of my brothers and I, through elementary school, you know, we were bullied and persecuted and pushed around for having those views.
Wow.
And then, when I was in high school, I was the president of the political science club in high school. And in high school, you had to have a teacher. The teacher who was the sponsor of the political science club was a guy named Mr. DeMarco. I don't know his first name because, he was an adult, so to me he was Mr. DeMarco.
Yeah, right.
And one of the things the political science club had done, you know, for years and years before I became president, was that it helped the Democrat candidates in the city of Utica. You know, the kids did volunteer work for the Democrat mayoral candidates, Democrat congressional delegates, and the rationale was, well, this is teaching the kids political science and what politics is all about. And I said to Mr. DeMarco, I thought that this was inappropriate. Why don't we give equal help to the Republicans? And he got really mad at me and threatened that he was going to demand that I resign as president of the political science club, or that he would resign as our sponsor and there would be no political science club. In the end, my father forced me to go along with this because I had to respect adult authority, okay? And, you know, it turned out that DeMarco was a Democrat Party ward captain in addition to being a high school teacher. And he
answered a guy named
Elefante, who was not only a Democrat captain in the city of Utica, but tied up with the mafia, all right? So the corruption has been around. And violence, of course, in my college years, you know, I had my room trashed. This was back in the 70s, you know, for being a conservative. Had a swastika painted on my car.
Wow.
So this kind of radicalism has been with us and been tolerated from the left for a long, long time. And it was just foreseeable, inevitable, that it would become a totalitarian movement eventually. And just from the experience of my own life, this was foreseeable. But in national security terms, so I'll say a little, well, it's something about that, national security and the Orwellian America, you know, if the left delivers on what it's been talking about, for example, Adam Smith, who's the chairman, the Democrat chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, as soon as the Democrats got hold of the House Armed Services Committee, and that's really significant, their leadership, the Democrat leadership, what a guy like Adam Smith thinks, is a bellwether for where the Democrats are going to go. Because right now, the most influential and powerful part of the government that affects national security policy, controlled by Democrats, is the House Armed Services Committee. And what he wants to do, you know, is basically dismantle the nuclear triad, that is the strategic bombers, the land-based ICBMs, the ballistic missile submarines. To get rid of the bombers, get rid of the ICBMs, we don't need them anymore, rely only on a monad of ballistic missile submarines, and half the numbers, you know, we're supposed to deploy, you know, supposed to have a fleet of 12 ballistic missile, Columbia-class ballistic missile submarines in the future, and he wants to cut that in half to 6. And what that means that is that we would be able to sustain on patrol at sea 2 submarines, one in the Atlantic and one in the Pacific, on a day-to-day basis. Because you need 2/3 of the subs have to stay at port for maintenance, refurbishment, that sort of thing, let the crews go in R&R to recover from these long patrols. So our whole national security against the nuclear threat will hinge upon 2 ballistic missile submarines. Right now it hinges upon 4, but that's a radical change, you know, to reduce it so much. So that's the nuclear balance. Where the conventional balance is concerned, I don't see us investing money to deal with things like robotic unmanned air forces in the future that may be mounted by our enemies, great and small, because there isn't going to be any money in the defense budget for that. We'll basically be stuck with the forces that we've got right now, which, contrary to President Trump, I mean, he's the commander-in-chief, and he's always got the commander-in-chief can't say, well, we've invested trillions of dollars, and our modernization isn't finished yet. I haven't repaired the damage done by the Obama administration, but we're on the way there. That's not what a commander-in-chief can afford to say. You know, to admit weakness at that level is not what a commander-in-chief is. Our forces, when the president speaks, have always got to be bigger and better and more advanced than anybody else's. But the truth is, we haven't repaired the damage from the Obama years yet. We've made progress, but we're not there yet. You know, there's a lot of fundamentals, and what we are spending money on may not be the smartest thing to spend money on in the strategic environment we're facing. For example, you know, we're investing, you know, billions of dollars in the super-duper F-35 fighter, you know, that, yes, maybe we need a fighter like that to take on the super-duper fighters that the Russians are building. But one might make a pause when you think, well, look what these little drones did, these armed drones, you know, an air power on the cheap,
stealth
on the cheap. You know, what just happened to the Azerbaijan war, Armenian-Azerbaijan war. But there's not even going to be a lot of thought about that. I think under this Orwellian regime, the concept of national security is going to be directed inward, you know, against, well, people like you and I and people who listen to this radio station. We're the real threat to national security.
Mm-hmm.
The white supremacists, the people who believe in our history and believe in the old system, you know, they've got to be rooted out. You know, it's not enough for us to simply be made politically powerless. You know, our minds, our thinking has to change, which is, in a way, what I think the mask wearing is symptomatic of.
Sure.
And the fear about the coronavirus supposedly being the plague. You know, this is all I can make many criticisms of, I'm a Trump supporter, I support President Trump, but it might have been fatal for America in the long run for him to have made the decision to shut down the economy and open the door to this immense violation of the Constitution and of people's civil rights.
Yeah,
it's not
and
even
knowing
questioned except in a few places. You
well,
know,
and
like
knowing what
problem.
We know now, I kind of give them the benefit of the doubt, knowing you know what little they were working with at that time, but knowing what we know now, closing everything down is obviously silly, and there's no basis for that. But we have to take a really quick break. I found you a little song about your dad, so I thought you'd enjoy that. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and you're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Yeah, I'm seeing my father in me. I guess that's how it's meant to be. And I find more and more like him each day. I notice I walk the way he walks. I notice I talk the way he talks. I'm starting to see my father.
There. That'd be the theme song if Joe Biden takes over. We'll play that every quarter hour. We won't need any other songs. We'll just play that. So, Dr. Pry?
Yes.
You see?
Oh, thank you for playing that tribute to my father during the break.
I couldn't find a song that says I voted like him, but if I had it, I would have.
Well, it brought to mind something else about that little story I was telling about the elementary school persecution that the Pry Boys experienced during the Kennedy-Nixon race in the 1960. And I remember going back home, and I was really angry at my father. And I told my father, I said, you know, why are you going to vote for Nixon? He's going to lose, you know. Why don't you vote for the guy who's going to win? And I think I learned one of my first important lessons in life. My father calmly explained to me that it's always more important to do the right thing, even if you lose. And at that age, I still couldn't comprehend it, okay? I just knew we were going to lose. As it happens, historically, Nixon probably didn't lose that election. It was probably stolen from him by Joseph Kennedy, who worked out a deal with the Chicago mob and the Daily Machine, because Nixon theoretically lost, you know, by a very small number of votes. But a lot of historians believe that election was stolen.
Well, I can tell you, I met a woman in Red Bluff. I've made mention of her before, and she told me she voted in the Kennedy election, but she obviously wasn't old enough, and so I thought she, you know, maybe just well preserved or something. And she said, oh, no, I was 5 years old. My uncle was a mob boss in Chicago.
Well,
and,
there you go.
And they lined up all of us kids. She said there were dozens and dozens and dozens of kids at the polling place, little kids. She's 5 years old. And, no voter fraud problem there. They gave him a little piece of paper. They told him that they'd give him money. And here, we'll give you money. When you come out, you got to go, I don't know, check this box or punch that thing or whatever the deal was. And it had Kennedy on there, and she had to go in and vote for Kennedy. And the kids were kind of laughing in line. They said, well, what if we don't do that? You know, they're not going to know. And her older brother said, they'll know. And if you do it, Dad's in big trouble. Don't do anything different than what they said. So.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. You should write an article about that.
I'm like, voted when she was five. What the heck?
Right. Yeah, my father was, he wanted us to think for ourselves. So he did not try brainwashing us. I didn't even know what my father's political convictions were. I mean, his obsession was not politics, but it was fishing. And he wanted us to be free to come up with our own political views, our own religious views, and beliefs in God and things of that sort. So, you know, he let us grow free in that respect. But he did, because I would pester him about these things. And maybe it was when I was 12. I can't remember. But he gave me a book, Barry Goldwater's The Conscience of a Conservative. And that was a definitive movement for me, where I really understood the principles that my father was trying to stand up for in his way, you know, as a persecuted minority, conservative Republican in a union town. I don't know where we are time-wise here. Do we have time to talk about the unknown history of Thanksgiving
We do. We've got like 5 till the last break, and then we've got, you know, 12 to the top of the hour, so.
I don't know how much time that is. I don't have a clock in front of me.
Oh, well, it's 1:39.
She'll let you know.
I'll give you the high sign. Let's say 20 minutes plus or minus.
Okay. Well, maybe that's that. You know, we're all going to sit down to Thanksgiving this Thursday, third Thursday in November, and most people probably know that Abraham Lincoln, you know, started the Thanksgiving tradition in the middle of the Civil War, the American Civil War. You know, all history is written by the winners, they say, and so Lincoln gets, you know, big points from historians for his magnanimity in establishing Thanksgiving in the middle of this divided America. And the way it's interpreted, and maybe it's true, I don't want to be too cynical here. You hear enough, I don't want to make even Thanksgiving, you know, too political. But, you know, as another example of Lincoln's greatness and saintliness by trying to rise above the bitterness of the Civil War by having an event that draws together not just families, but the idea that the American family of a divided North and South that are killing each other off in the middle of this war, that maybe we should come together. And that's usually the interpretation that's put on it. And in fairness, you know, Lincoln himself may well have, probably did, think along those lines. You know, but the truth, the fact of the matter is, I shouldn't say the truth, but something, perhaps it was unknown to Lincoln. But there had been the Thanksgiving that was founded, adopted by America, and that we have celebrated ever since, accepts that the founding of America happened in the North, in the New Plymouth Colony, when Plymouth Colony was established in 1620. You know, pilgrims had come to New England and established New Plymouth in search of religious freedom. That's the story. And so we're celebrating. And, of course, there was a famous feast reported in William Bradford's diary or history of the history of Plymouth Colony, where the pilgrims had a dinner. We don't know when, but it was probably in the fall sometime, you know, with the local the Wampanoag Indians. They had an alliance with the local chief. And so, in addition to symbolizing political freedom, well, religious freedom, here you have a coming together of diverse groups, you know, as a family, and living in peace and celebrating. And that's a wonderful vision, and it's a true vision. That actually happened. You know, I'm not, you know, Bradford's diary is accurate. But what isn't told is that before the Civil War, there was actually, among historians of the North and South, there was a great debate over what the founding, real founding moment of America was. And Southerners argued that the real founding moment of America was in the Jamestown Colony, you know, which was established almost 2 decades before New Plymouth Colony in 1607. And it had a different vision for America. It was a commercial vision. The Jamestown Colony was basically focused on not religious freedom, but commercial freedom, you know, to let these people loose on the new world, to come up with a way to make a lot of money that could be sent back to the old world, and maybe themselves return to the old world. And one might call it a celebration of an unbridled free enterprise or capitalist system, part of that story from the South, pre-Civil War Southern point of view, of course, was slavery, you know, because that's what the modern 1619 Project is about. you know, in 1619, that's when the first slaves came to America, and they came to Jamestown Colony. So it may be, it's a little hard to believe that Lincoln wasn't aware of that, you know, and of that debate, and that's why he wouldn't have preferred to start America off, the American idea off, with the founding of Jamestown Colony. And another argument that could be made there is that, you know, the Jamestown Colony ended up failing, in fact, failing so badly that we even lost track of it. You know, it was only rediscovered in modern times.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't get along with the Indians down there in Jamestown. There was a war with the Indians. You know, hundreds of the original colonists were killed. And so the colony basically wasn't a success in Jamestown. So one could make an argument there that's why, even though Plymouth was settled later, that it really is the basis for what became America, the vision for what became America. And but there is a one of the other major factors, I think, that made the Pilgrims win out at New Plymouth for the people we identify with Thanksgiving as opposed to the Jamestown colonists is a guy named William Bradford, who was the leader of the New Plymouth colony, later became its governor, and lived there for many years, and he wrote a history of the establishing of New Plymouth. And Bradford was a brilliant guy and a lucid writer, and none of the other colonies, Jamestown certainly, didn't have a William Bradford writing the story for them. So that was another big factor that the New Plymouth colony had going for it, and why we think of the Pilgrims when we think of Thanksgiving. But maybe one doesn't want to think about this. I mean, I'm going to think about the Pilgrims, too, on Thanksgiving and about the founding of America and all the rest.
When you grow up back east, you kind of have to because you're surrounded by all of that. And I kind of feel sorry for people who've never lived on the eastern seaboard.
Hey, we learned about Sutter's Fort.
Yeah,
and, you know,
missions. You guys don't know squeak about the Revolution.
No, we don't.
It's kind of fun.
We didn't have that out here.
It's nice living in Revolutionary War country. You get to see it. You know what it looked like, and so when you read about it in a book, it isn't just some faraway story that can be changed by a bunch of people tossing over statues. Quick break. Be right back. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
All my wolves begin to howl. Wake me up, the time is now. Oh, can you hear the drum hit? Oh, there's a revolution coming.
Wide awake, the fever burns. Sweat it out, lay my turn.
Can you hear the drum hit? There's a revolution coming.
All this doubt is creeping in, inside out.
One thing you should always find, you gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
Nothing like a beer drinking horse, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Nothing like whiskey drinking people. Our favorite song. Okay. So, what else don't we know about Thanksgiving, Dr. Pry? Or what did systematically suppressed?
One of the things we don't know about it is that the Pilgrims, at least William Bradford, their leader, also thought that their colony failed. But for different reasons than Jamestown. Jamestown failed because the people died, the people wiped out, and the colony simply ceased to exist. But the reason the Pilgrims came to America, you know, was for religious freedom for themselves. You know, they believed in they rejected, not only did they reject Catholicism, but they also rejected the new church, official Church of England, that was headed by the king. They wanted to get back to the way the early Christians worshipped, so that it was supposed to be a small community, intimate community, shorn of the symbolisms and rituals that had grown up in the church, in the official churches, over the centuries since the passing of Christ. And so they wanted to, and to read the Bible, which was a new and revolutionary thing. You know, when the Bible started getting printed, it's what caused the Protestant Reformation, the Protestant Revolution, really. You know, a whole war was fought over it, the 30 Years' War, between the Catholic Church, which used to be the dominant church and was called and identified with Christendom, versus those who said, no, the church shouldn't be the authority on these spiritual matters. Every man can have a personal relationship with God. And I have a responsibility to educate myself and read for myself in my own language, English, what the Holy Book says. That's what the pilgrims were about. And, yeah, they had a commercial dimension. They had to make money and send furs and other products back to England to pay off the expenses of establishing their colony. But that wasn't chiefly what they were about, achieving wealth. What Bradford wanted, was to basically have some safe space, in America where they could worship the way they pleased, not be persecuted for it, and in a small, intimate community that would where people would have close relations with each other and with Christ and God. And he felt, at the end, he concluded that that was a failure because the New World turned out to be a huge economic success. By 1675, there were 70,000 people living in New England. The New Plymouth Colony had started off with fewer than 100 people. And most of them were down in Boston, and it was largely a commercial enterprise. And a lot of the people who started the Plymouth Colony moved out. In part, they fractured because of spiritual disagreements. That was one of the things the Catholic Church was always afraid of, that once you started this idea of an individual relationship with God, that the church would fragment, that the faith would fragment into hundreds of pieces. And that happened with Bradford, too. So in his history of New Plymouth Colony, he sees the New Plymouth Colony as also a failure. And so that's the other unknown thing. There's actually a good documentary on this made by National Geographic called The Pilgrims. And if you want the history of a Bradford plays a central role in it, as he should. If you want to know the real story about the Pilgrims, there it is. I'd recommend seeing that. Now, here's my own contribution to this great debate, okay? In between, geographically and ideologically, in between Jamestown and Plymouth Colony in New England was another colony in Maryland, the Colony of Maryland, about not exactly halfway between them, but it was in between them, geographically and ideologically as well. It was established a little later in 1632 and at a place called St. Mary's City, which was their first. And I have always thought that this is the place where America really started. And in fact, it's a little something of a miracle. Maryland was a Catholic colony. The Catholics were horrifically persecuted in England. And as with many people who have experienced that kind of persecution, they didn't want it to happen to anybody else. And so the charter of the colony, even though Catholicism was permitted, okay, it wasn't the dominant religion, all religions were welcome. Any belief was welcome. They got along well with the Indians. Many Indians even converted. And what's amazing, in this early colony, for the first decade of its existence, it was in microcosm, I think, all the promise of what America would eventually become. Women could vote. Minorities could vote. There were some black minorities living in Maryland, and they had to vote too. Women could own land, which was unheard of in much of Europe. A society that was an equal opportunity society, where regardless of your creed or race or sex, you know, you were given equal opportunity and you had rights that were protected. And what's amazing to me, and why I consider this a little miraculous, and a sign of promise that there is a light at the end of the road, even after the Orwellian nightmare of what is likely to be a Biden administration, okay?
Yeah.
If you think of how backward and oppressive and medieval the attitudes were in Europe, and the kind of people that were produced by those societies, but you put them in the ground of freedom, right, for just 10 years, and suddenly you have this thing that looks like the fundamentals of America today, you know, a freedom-oriented society, an opportunity-oriented society. And that's what they had. But it's also a sad story, because St. Mary's City was obviously named after the Virgin Mary, and the Catholic Maryland of Colony, that little miracle lasted only 10 years. It's our American Camelot. You know, what happened is the English Civil War broke out between Charles I, you know, who tended to be, he was suspected of being a Catholic. He probably was. His wife was definitely Catholic, his queen, and the Protestant Parliament. And so it was not only a religious struggle, but it was also a struggle between who would have power, you know, the Parliament or the king. And but the religion figured very large in that. And Maryland became, because it had a Catholic colony, it was the only colony in America that got involved, that had imposed upon it. They didn't volunteer to get involved. It came to us. And the English Civil War crossed the Atlantic and hit the Maryland colony. The Parliament sent basically pirates and mercenaries to attack the colony. The Puritans in New England and the pro-parliamentary forces in Virginia were recruited by Parliament to invade Maryland. And in Maryland's history, it's a two-year period during the English Civil War, which happened in the 1640s, called the Plundering Time, where one of the other miracles of Maryland in that 10 years, you know, big plantations had driven, you know, had really blossomed into a very successful, commercially successful society, a booming St. Mary City, great plantations. In fact, I used to own a horse farm in the Chesapeake Bay that comprised the last 100 acres of what had once been a 20,000 acre tobacco plantation in Maryland.
Wow.
And in this plundering time, all of that was destroyed. And the not only materially destroyed, but the freedom was destroyed.
Yeah, look at Maryland now. Dr. Pry, we have hit the limit.
Ah, what a shame.
I know. So much more to say. And we will talk to you soon, I'm sure, because we love getting all your intel. It makes the world a lot more interesting and a lot more colorful, since we're only being spoon-fed little tiny bits at a time. Thank you so much for joining us. You can find the recording of this with it, The Free Enterprise Taken Out, at wethepeopleradio.us. Join us next week.